We'll go. You got it? All right, go ahead, grab your seats if you don't mind. We all have some curling to watch, right, at 9:30? Or... I watch curling once every 4 years, and I love it, man. Then I just leave it next time. We lost to the States in curling. How do we lose to the States in curling? Like basketball, you know, things like that, but not curling. That's just wrong. All right, session three. Hey, Matt, maybe at the end, we'll just kind of take these questions. I'll stack them up. Maybe I'll ask you to come up here and we can address them together. Is that cool? Or are you heading out? Really? Were you? Oh, man. Is Melissa waiting for you? Oh, all right. Text her. See, undivided, right? He's got divided loyalties. It's unbelievable. That's a perfect example. All right. Session three, the dangers and pitfalls that come with singles. I feel like, by the way, that this is just, you know, fire hose of stuff. Like every one of these sessions we could, in what I'm calling sessions, are, you know, things that we could spend a lot more time on, but gives you a sense anyway. So the dangers and pitfalls that come with singleness, I'll subtitle this The Idol of Marriage and Common Mistakes Made Along the Way. First of all, what is an idol? Because we don't really think about idols today in the same way that the term was used back in the day. But in simple terms, an idol in the context of 2018 Vancouver is a good thing that's become ultimate. And for some, marriage has become an idol, has become ultimate. Marriage, just to be really clear, and I've stated this already in the last hour, is a good thing. Parenthood and kids are good things. Romance is a good thing. Physical attraction is a good thing. Sex is a good thing too. But when good things become ultimate things, they move to a place of worship. They take on godlike status. So every thought, every movement, our time and action focuses on them. Tied into this and spoken of earlier, oftentimes our very identity rests on them. They rest on the things we worship, whether that be marriage and or being a parent. Therefore, if that's in fact true, maybe not true in your life, but it's certainly true in others, if that is the idol that marriage and or parenting can turn into, then what is the greatest danger attached to singleness? Well, the greatest danger from my perspective attached to singleness, in fact, this is attached to those that aren't single, those in marriage relationships, believe it or not, but certainly singleness, the greatest danger is loneliness. That's why I believe God says of Adam in Genesis 2, it's not good to be alone. Loneliness, being alone, is a great danger. It's hazardous. It can bring with it cataclysmic results. It just can. So when, and again, I tried to think through this and answer the question, when are those times for people that are living single lives now? When is loneliness at its highest pitch? Here are some things I wrote down, and this is not exhaustive, and I'm sure you can add some. But when your single friends get married, especially someone really, really close to you, like you're the best man or the maid of honor, like that can bring great loneliness in the wake of it. When you're out with your couple friends, they're the worst, right? The worst. Holidays, like vacations, like when you get your vacation time comes when nobody else has it. That's a lonely time. At the end of the day, when you go home alone, it's lonely. family gatherings, as I mentioned before, when well-meaning parents or siblings just say stupid things, right? Just, I got to get out of here, man. It's 6:30 already. I gotta go. When tragedy strikes, like death, like when loneliness is thrust upon you, death of a spouse, abandonment by a spouse, unfaithfulness, divorce. I'm sure you could add more. And when you mix loneliness and you double down on it with what has become ultimate, and you add parental or societal pressure, you add a cocktail or two or three, you sprinkle in some anger, some possible entitlement, along with an enemy who loves to kill and destroy, then tragic decisions are often made. You know what I'm talking about? Coming in the form of fantasy, colored in 50 shades of gray, or porn and masturbation to follow, or hooking up a night where the guard is just let down, or dating a non-believer or someone who is way lower than the standards you have. It can lead to marrying a non-believer or marrying to satisfy or prove something to another. Again, a parent or a friend or a sibling or what have you. Or having kids to solve things. The marriage is bad, so let's solve it by having a kid. Or marrying to heal the pain or pressure. Again, I think you could probably add more. Ironically, marriage and parenthood is, in the long run at least, is not a healer of pain or a remover of pressure, but the exacerbator of them. In math, if you have I'm not a math wizard, a negative and a negative equals a positive, right? 3 + 3 = 6, for example. It doesn't work that way in marriage. A negative and a negative is more negative, right? That's how marriage works. What you bring in into the marriage will show itself. That's the beauty of it. It should. But if you go in expecting that it won't, you're going to be thoroughly disappointed. As someone has written, and I can't remember who, but marriage is to be seen as a sanctifier of us, a maturer, not a remover of issues. So loneliness is not good. It was the only not good pre-fall. So how do you battle it? Well, let me give you a bunch of ways that you can take down, and maybe some of these are encouraging to you or helpful. Here's the first. You need to put marriage and parenting back in its rightful place. Both are good, but so too is singleness. It's not meant to be worshipped. As mentioned earlier, romantic love can be idolized. In the Screwtape Letters, if you've read the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, a demon promotes the false idea that being in love is the only thing that makes marriage either happy or holy. A romanticized idea of love can seriously mislead men and women alike. So that's one. We need to have a proper perspective. It's not ultimate. It's a good thing, but it's not an ultimate thing. Secondly, you become aware of your pitfalls. Do you know your triggers? I mean, we all have triggers, right? Those episodes, those days, those whatever events that give us the excuse to do whatever. You know what I mean? So what are those for you? What is that event? Like, if you know going to a family gathering is going to probably leave you feeling like that, knowing beforehand is a good and helpful thing so that you don't use that as a trigger to, again, you fill in the blank on how that gets fleshed out. So you become aware of those triggers, those pitfalls, those times that make you susceptible. We all have them. A third way in terms of battling this is you have some hard and frank conversations with your parents, your friends, or what have you. People that are well-meaning that speak into your life, but they have no clue on what that does to you emotionally. Tied in with this, you need to see your parents for what they are. They're imperfect at best. Like, you realize that, right? Some of you really, really realize that. But even the best of parents are imperfect. They, too, have their idols. Their idol may be grandparenting. And they've got to stop worshiping it. Because they're calling you to steward something that you may not be, in fact, called to steward. And so they bring that into the family, and it leads to much pressure. Leaving our parents, so to speak, can happen before we cleave to another. Does that make sense? We need to honor our parents. I'm a parent. My dad is still alive. I want to honor him. But whether I got married or not, there's an aspect to my life and your life too where we leave and we're not direct. We honor, but we move on too. And we realize that they're not perfect. I'm not perfect. There are things that I've learned. There's things that I've not. There's things I'm going to steward. There's things I'm not going to steward, regardless of the pressure. And we respond graciously with them, but we need to make sure that you and I, we live the lives that God has called us to live. While honoring them, honor isn't obey. Honor is honor. You can honor your parents without obeying your parents. Parents in here are probably mad at me when I say that. That's all right. So how do you battle this? A fifth way is you receive my forgiveness on behalf of the church if we've ever made you feel less than. If we've ever made you feel less than honored. And forgive flippant statements that can be said up front a night like this. So you receive my forgiveness on behalf of the church. I think the church has much that it needs to own in this. I think it's at times only promoted or push people towards making something an idol that shouldn't be. Another, you be aware of those left behind. In other words, you be aware of others' loneliness when you leave yours. Another, this is very specific. You be cognizant of alcohol and the role it plays with our enemy. Paul writes in Ephesians 5:18, do not get drunk on wine, but be filled with the Spirit. Become very susceptible to our enemy by way of booze or what have you. And we need to be cognizant of that. You open yourself up to the fellowship, meaning you risk becoming known. You risk being involved. You risk being transparent. You risk being present. That God does have a family for you. He has people available to you. You also be aware of the chip on your shoulder that some people can have when it comes to this topic, meaning you're ready to get angry. You're ready to hear one thing and you're ready to take that and use that as a reason to, and again, you fill in the blank and how that gets fleshed out. There can be a tendency, and I want to say this gently, but I have to say it, there can be a tendency to hypersensitivity when it comes to this topic. I certainly have chips on my shoulder regarding certain topics. So I'm certain that this one brings them to. Another, you see singleness not as what or who you are, but how you are. It's not your identity. It's just how you are right now. And it may be like that for a while, maybe that for the rest of your life, but it's not who you are. You're a child of God. You also become comfortable in being misunderstood and miscategorized. Just don't take on anyone else's category for you. But you become, Jesus was called a glutton and a drunkard. And so there'll be some categories, even those close to you may label you with, and there needs to be an aspect where you go, God sees, God sees. Tied in with this, you, and most importantly, because all of the other things flesh itself out through this, is you pursue Christ. You pursue Christ. You become other world-minded. You take him at his word. You cast your eyes heavenward. So when I say pursue Christ, what do I mean by that? I mean you become very disciplined. That you become very jealous of your time with him. Whether that be your mornings, whether that be your nights, whether that be other times, whether that be walks in the park where it's just you and Jesus, whether it's going for a drive where I love my car. I love driving in my car and I love putting on things in my car and just me, it's me and Jesus time. I love it. I love the endowment lands. I go for walks with Jesus in the endowment lands. I love my morning times. I love my time with Christ. I just pursue it. My times of fasting, you pursue it. It's you and Jesus. You give Jesus. You're just jealous about your time with Jesus. And you're honest with him and you cry out to him and you lay yourself bare because he knows more about you than you know about you. So you pursue Christ. And then lastly, you lower your standards. Now, what do I mean? This sounds inconsistent because I said earlier, what are you talking about lowering my standards? Some people like they lower their standards. Here's what I mean. Let me try to press in on this a little bit. Here's my point in this. Your standards for who you marry needs to be high, but sometimes standards can become unreasonable. Like it's that toilet paper roll, right? That list where you just unravel. Here's what they need to be, right? Here's what they need to be. Your list of non-negotiables perhaps should be a tad more negotiable. Again, like I said, don't create a list that even Jesus couldn't satisfy, right? See, tied in with this, and here's why I say this, because I've heard some of the discussion. Marriage should be, and will be, whether you like it or not, a time of discovery. Like it should be and it will be a time of discovery. If you are waiting until every question is answered before you get married, you'll be thoroughly surprised at how many things come to light post-wedding day. There are answers about what you're like and what your spouse is like that only marriage will bring to light. Like that's one of the roles that it serves. Marriage shouldn't be rushed into, but there is no perfect time to get married, just better times than others. So just be careful about having everything in line. Furthermore, I also call you in this to remember that love is not, and I don't want to sound cheesy. I know this sounds like fluff, but it's so important. It's important to remember that love is not only an emotion, but a choice. Like the best marriage in the Bible, perhaps, Isaac and Rebecca, was prearranged for crying out loud. Like the language of that marriage is they got married and they fell in love. Like in that order. And to put your mind at ease, or tied in with this, my point in saying that is we can choose love. We can. And to put your mind at ease, there is no such thing as falling out of love. It's not a thing. If that were the case, then Jesus' call to love our neighbor as ourselves would be unfair, unreasonable, and unattainable. And who more our neighbor than the one we share a bed with? So don't confuse falling out of love with choosing to no longer love. They're not the same thing. So I'm not trying to rush you into something. So if you just started dating someone last week, I'm not saying like, hey, Norm said get married. We'll figure things out, right? I'm not saying, I don't want you to hear me. You need to be careful. You need to get to know one another. You need to go through some seasons. If you've never seen him or her at their worst, wait until that happens. I think all of that's good. I think we can rush. Even though my in-laws, my mom and dad-in-law, they got married after a week. Isn't that crazy? Like, that's crazy. But so, can I sidebar on this one? I'll just tell you how crazy this is. When they went to get married, the justice of the peace, she, my mother-in-law, didn't even know how old he was. And so when she was writing down on the license, by the way, how old are you? He's 9 years older than her. And she was like, you're 9 years older than me. I mean, she wanted to back out. And so it was crazy. So she went, they went back to their, after they got married, went back to his apartment. They were living in Winnipeg at the time. He had another woman's name on his pillow. Like how weird is it to have another, like a name on a pillow? But she took the pillow on their wedding night and threw it out the window. That's how she started marriage. So take your time. Don't do that. So, but I think we can, my point in this is I think we need to be very careful in thinking that we're going to have everything answered, everything figured out, everything determined. I'll know everything about this person before. And the fact of the matter is you won't and you shouldn't. That's the beauty of growing together. Like I said, I've almost been married 24 years. I'm still trying to figure it out. Still getting to know my wife. And still getting to see the things that need to be figured out in me too. So I want to be very cautious. Don't quote me by saying, like I said, going out and getting married just really quickly. But I'm saying maybe you don't need to wait 7 years. Maybe, in fact, the fact you're waited 7 years and he's waiting with you or she's waiting, maybe that's a good reason to exit. From that one. So let me stop there. I'll pause.